Radio Naturopath, the talk show about health and natural medicine. This show will first be broadcast on Wednesday, July 29, 2026, on 91.7 FM WHUS Stores. I am Fran Storch, ND, naturopathic physician. My co-host Ron Meniza is out and about teaching classes and registrar of voting. We're coming to you live from beautiful Mansfield Hollow, Connecticut. Comment below to let us know you're here and ask questions. You can also email me at radionaturopath@gmail.com. If you'd like to listen to this show at another time, you can check out our podcast at whus.org, iTunes, Spotify, Patreon, and Buzzsprout. You may also watch the recorded Facebook Live episode at Fran Storch ND for 30 days, and also on my YouTube channel at Radio Naturopath. The views expressed on this program do not reflect the views of the staff, management, or licensee of this station. The information presented on this show should not be construed as medical advice or direction. If you're having a medical condition, please consult with your physician. Lyme stuff. Lyme is going pretty good. I really feel like treating the Lyme. I'm going to do a total probably of 2 months of amoxicillin, and I'm taking a few select Buhner herbs and taking modified citrus pectin and chlorella and cordyceps, because as I told you, it's a great adaptogen. I'm going to be taking that ongoing for a while because I think it does help my energy, probably the chlorella as well. And then the next thing I'm going to do is really make an effort to not eat sugar, to stay away from sugar as much as possible. I avoided sugar, like I didn't have dessert the last two nights. And yes, I'm a person who eats sugar. Right. But I bet you are too. Some of you are not. I understand. But sugar is that's my vice. And last night I didn't eat any dessert, and I didn't and then the night before I had very low sugar dessert, just, a blueberry crumble with maple syrup in it. And that's all I had. And last night with the no dessert, I think I slept better and I got up early and I had a lot of energy. So you don't realize how much eating sugar affects your energy, regardless of what else is going on with you. So we're going to see if the sugar helps me keep the Lyme disease away, increases my energy, and also reduces pain and inflammation, because I am still having spinal stenosis pain and weakness in my back and my legs. I am riding my bike, but I'm limited as to how much I can do because I'm having to manage the pain with a lot of ice. I have a neuromuscular electrical stim device. I have red light therapy. I have all kinds of creams and stuff, and I'm taking anti-inflammatory supplements, and I'm still struggling with pain and struggling with weakness in my legs, and I don't want it to get worse. So clearly I still have pressure on my femoral nerve on the left side. So today, after not having been there for a while, I'm going to go to Crossroads and I'm going to get some nice PT. So I'm looking forward to that. And I think I have chiropractic next week, so I have sprinkled throughout. I have physical therapy, and I have chiropractic and acupuncture, and those things help, but nothing is helping 100%, because I don't think anything can help nothing can help the anatomy. Nothing can help the fact that I have anatomy that is sitting on my femoral nerve and possibly the scar tissue that's on the thecal sac and also on the nerve root at L4. So if I'm going to give it another couple of weeks or so and see if I can get anywhere. And I'm thinking of scheduling an appointment with another neurosurgeon and seeing if there's any more non-invasive stuff that I can do. At this point in my life, I can't afford to take the time off to recover from a spinal fusion. But if there's non-invasive stuff where there's an easy recovery time, a week or two, that I can afford to do. So I'm going to see if that's a possibility for me. That's interesting stuff. In terms of the Lyme, I'm pretty happy with where I'm at. It looks like if I indeed had Lyme disease, and I also got drawn for the boutique lab, and I'm waiting for the results on that. That's going to take a couple of weeks to come back. And at that point, I'll go and see my naturopath, Miss Marissa, over at Dow Vitality. And so we'll talk about that and see if there's anything else I want to do. And I think I'm going to do some low grade, even if I'm not doing the killer herbs. Right now I'm taking Hotunia, Cryptoleptis, and Kudzu. And if I back off on those, I'm going to probably continue to do the modified citrus pectin. I will definitely continue the chlorella, and I will definitely continue the cordyceps for a while. So ongoing, and see if that's going to help with detox and stuff. So that's what's going on with my health. I'm frustrated with my leg pain right now. And so I'm going to keep on doing stuff to work on that. And one thing I have not tried is really assiduously staying away from sugar. And so I'm going to try that and see what happens. The other thing that may happen is I may drop a few pounds. And it shows, the studies that show if you drop 10 pounds, especially off of your abdomen, it can significantly decrease pain. So before I go for surgery, I should try that because I have a few pounds I could lose safely. I don't feel like I need to be super skinny, but I definitely could lose weight off my tummy. Now, 62-year-old, postmenopausal, it's going to be hard to do. And it's easier to do if you can get regular exercise. So I'm going to try to get the regular exercise and then manage the results after the regular exercise with lots of stretching and ice and all my devices and physical therapy and stuff, and see if I can get through this without needing more surgery. And if I can't, then I'll have to have more surgery. I'm not excited about that, but like I said, I don't think if I can get through this until I'm at least 65 and I can afford to take a bunch of weeks off to recover from a fusion, because fusion is no laughing matter. I mean, you can't really work for a few weeks after you have a spinal fusion. So and I just can't afford that, and it's heartbreaking because there are people who struggle, who lose their livelihoods because their back pain and their leg pain is so bad, and they can't afford to have the surgery. So I don't know what I'm going to do. Anyway, in the meantime, I'm doing the best that I can at the moment. And I am thinking about seeing another neurosurgeon to see if there's more non-invasive procedures that they can do to get this pressure off this femoral nerve. Because Dr. Lantner said I was okay. And I'm not 100% happy with where I'm at. Nothing against him. This is my body. This is what happened. And that was his opinion based on what was going on that he saw in my spine at the time. But I want to be able to ride my bike and not have pain afterwards. I want to be able to stand up and not feel like there's a lot of pressure on my legs without having to every single time do all of the exercises and all of the things to keep it at bay. I mean, I'm willing to do some regular PT and regular stretching and stuff like that. But we're managing a situation this is not how I want to be for the rest of my life. And my concern is that it's going to just keep getting worse because as I'll get older, some more time passes, there's more stress and pressure on the nerves. And is it going to get worse? Am I going to stand up one day and fall down and not be able to get up? Am I going to get caught Aquinas syndrome? I don't know. So anyway, that's what's going on with that. Ron is out and about. His tummy is good. His neck is reasonable. He gets cramping sometimes. He's working on that. And that's what's going on. All right. So the next thing is let's talk about the latest on the cyclosporiasis outbreak. So there was a brand of lettuce that they were concerned about. I think it was called Taylor Farms, and that they voluntarily pulled their products off the shelf. And then the FDA tested the lettuce and found that the cyclosporiasis parasite was a false positive. So they are not sure where the cyclosporiasis is coming from. A lot of people are saying, I'm not going to eat produce for a while, which is not what you should do. I had a patient come in yesterday and say, I can't eat salad now. And I'm like, oh. So when they go to restaurants, there are some restaurants that are actually taking measures to protect their clients. So there's a local restaurant that is only sourcing their lettuce from a local farm, that's the thing to do. When you have a local farm and you know where the water's coming from, you know who the people working on the farm, you're very unlikely to get any kind of parasite. And we are continuing to eat lettuce. And what we do is we go to the Willimantic Food Co-op and we buy from local growers and we eat plenty of greens and lettuce and all kinds of vegetables. I'm not sure if I should be concerned about fruit from the supermarket because it doesn't seem to be coming from there. I did go pick blueberries last week from a local farm, which is great. And the farmer there gave me some raspberries from a neighbor, so I don't worry about those. But and then I'm not worried about the fruit from the Willimantic Food Co-op or any of the other local growers. So I'm getting local stuff. Fine, no problem. The number of cases in Connecticut is around 40. It might have gone up to close to 50. Remember, there are 3.5 million people in Connecticut, and a lot of them are still eating produce. And so the caseload in Connecticut is very low. So it's not somewhere that people commonly eat where this is coming from. So I think you're probably okay to continue to do what you do. Although I'm being more careful. The thing that I'm doing is I am shopping local whenever possible. I'm going to the farmers markets. I'm going to the food co-op, and I'm going to farm stands near my house. Now I can do that because I live in Mansfield and there's no end of opportunity to do that. So I'm still eating plenty of produce. And, you know, if I want to drop a few pounds, I'm going to have to eat produce because that's eating the fiber from the produce is really good. And it's very nutrient dense and it's helpful for me. And it's summer and I want to eat peaches. So I've been eating peaches pretty much every day. They do not come in a can. They were not put there by me, Fran. Anyway, so I'm enjoying my peaches every day. I cut up peaches and I put a little bit of fresh ground almond butter on top of them. Delicious. And I eat it with a spoon, so it's not messy. And I have organic cherries with that. And I have a small organic plum with that as well. So that's my first breakfast in the morning. And I really enjoy that. So that's what's going on with cyclosporiasis. It's the most cases are happening in Michigan. They're not happening in Connecticut like they are in Michigan. So there you go. All right. So the next thing on the agenda is there is a new cholesterol drug. It's called Lifendra and the generic name is Enlicitide and it is an oral PCSK9 inhibitor. So the other PCSK9 inhibitors, Evolocumab and, there are a couple of Repatha and a couple others. Lanesumab is another one. There are a couple of monoclonal antibody PCSK9 inhibitors, and they're all injectable. So this is the first oral PCSK9 inhibitor. It's kind of like the GLP-1s. Now there are GLP-1s you can get that are in a pill. So people would rather use a pill. Pills cause more compliance than injections, although motivated people will do the injections. And the thing with an injection is when people do the PCSK9 injections, they inject them twice a month. And in some cases, once a month. So you only have to do it once a month, but then you have to remember to do it. Sometimes people like to take a pill because a pill can be part of your routine and you don't forget about it. You put it on the counter, it's there. You just take it every day and you just get used to doing it as part of your routine. So that's why they came out with that. So what's a PCSK9 inhibitor? PCSK9 inhibitor inhibits the enzyme PCSK9. I can read off what that is. Anyway, PCSK9 is an enzyme that breaks down LDL, that's low-density lipoprotein, receptors on the liver. So low-density lipoprotein is the protein that carries cholesterol from your liver to the rest of your body for use. And if you have less LDL in your blood, the theory is that you're going to have less laying down of cholesterol in the rest of your body. So if you have a PCSK9 inhibitor, you have PCSK9 breaks down the receptors that pull LDL out of circulation on your liver. So when you have a PCSK9 inhibitor, it blocks that enzyme. Now you have more receptors for LDL cholesterol on and in your liver. So therefore, when your blood filters through your liver, it's going to get pulled out of circulation. The LDL is going to get pulled out of circulation. So you're going to have a lower circulatory burden of LDL cholesterol. Is that a good thing? Well, we'll talk about that. So anyway, again, if you take a pill, you're more likely to, just tends to support compliance. So it's the first oral PCSK9 inhibitor that's been approved by the FDA. And so this is what PCSK9 is. Proprotein convertase subtilisin cexin type 9. That's why it's not worth it to even read it out. PCSK9. And you want it to be an adjunct to diet and exercise to reduce your LDL or bad cholesterol in adults with high cholesterol, including those with heterozygous familial hypercholesterolemia. So that means you have a gene that makes you make a lot of cholesterol. PCSK9 inhibitors have previously been only available as injectables, and Lifendra is administered as a once daily oral tablet and gives an additional treatment option for adults who require further LDL reduction despite existing therapies. It also reflects continued advances in the development of therapies for chronic cardiovascular disease management. And cardiovascular disease remains the leading cause of death in the U.S., and elevated LDL is one of its most important modifiable risk factors, says this FDA doctor. The approval provides an additional treatment option for adults with high cholesterol and reflects the FDA's broader commitment to supporting meaningful advances in patient access and tackling chronic disease. High cholesterol occurs when there's too much LDL cholesterol in the blood. Over time, LDL can accumulate within the walls of arteries, contributing to the formation of plaques that narrow blood vessels and restrict blood flow. And if the plaque ruptures, it can trigger the formation of a blood clot, increasing the risk of heart attack or stroke. Because high cholesterol typically causes no symptoms, many people are unaware that they have the condition until detected through routine blood testing. Diet, physical inactivity, excess body weight, and inherited genetic conditions can all contribute to elevated cholesterol levels. There are several classes of medications to lower LDL, including statins, which are HMG-CoA reductase inhibitors. HMG-CoA reductase is a rate-limiting step in the production of cholesterol. It also is a rate-limiting step in the production of coenzyme Q10, which is why you have to take coenzyme Q10 if you take a statin. Then there's ezetimibe. Ezetimibe, also known as Zetia, the brand name is Zetia, but ezetimibe, it helps to increase excretion of cholesterol through stool. That's how ezetimibe works. And statins work very well. And ezetimibe works pretty well. And they're often given together. And then there's the injectable PCSK9 inhibitors, which work really well. They really lower your cholesterol a lot. And so Lifendra is the first oral therapy to inhibit PCSK9. And the efficacy and safety was evaluated in two randomized double-blind placebo-controlled trials involving over 3,000 adults with high cholesterol, including patients with the hereditary familial hypercholesterolemia who were receiving maximally tolerated statin therapy. So they were given as much dose of statin as they could tolerate physically. And the endpoint in both studies was the percentage of LDL from baseline to week 24 compared with placebo. And in the first trial, which enrolled adults with established atherosclerotic cardiovascular disease or those at high risk for ASCVD, patients had a mean baseline of 96 milligrams per deciliter. Treatment with Lifendra resulted in a 56% reduction in LDL. So they're starting out at 96 because they're treated, you know, because it's very hard to get down to 96 unless you're taking a drug for most people. And they had a average 56% reduction. Now their cholesterol sitting in the 50s, their LDL. What can I say? In the second trial, which enrolled adults with hereditary familial hypercholesterolemia, the participants had a mean baseline LDL of 119 milligrams per deciliter, which in my mind is not that bad, but that's what they had. And for someone with familial hypercholesterolemia, an LDL of 119 is very good. So they're actually being treated, and that's why it's that low. So treatment with Lifendra resulted in an average 59% reduction in LDL-C at week 24. So they're at 119. So now they're down in the 50s. So that's pretty tremendous. In the first trial, the frequency of adverse reactions was similar between patients treated with Lifendra and those receiving placebo. In the second trial, the most common adverse reactions occurring more frequently with Lifendra than placebo were diarrhea and dizziness. Across both trials, discontinuation rates due to adverse reactions were comparable between Lifendra and placebo. So people with think they're on a drug, even if it's a placebo, they're still going to get symptoms. How interesting is that? So Lifendra received priority review, and the application was reviewed under the Commissioner's Natural Priority Voucher Pilot Program to help accelerate the review of therapies that address national health issues. So there's this new PCSK9 inhibitor. All right. So we'll discuss the controversy around lowering cholesterol in a little bit. But first, let's talk about statins and weight gain. Interesting. So there's a question about whether statins cause weight gain. And this article was written in June, this past June. So some people taking statins may gain weight due to factors not directly related to the medication, but there's no evidence that statins themselves cause weight gain. So let's see about that. So weight gain is not a reported side effect of statin use, but gaining weight during statin treatment is possible, mainly due to changes in dietary habits. Limited evidence suggests that some statins may contribute to weight gain by lowering leptin levels. Remember, there's leptin and there's ghrelin. Leptin is the hormone that you make that increases your satiety. It makes you feel more full. Ghrelin is the hormone that makes you feel like your stomach is growling from ghrelin, right? So ghrelin is something that your stomach releases and it makes you feel like you're hungry. So if you reduce leptin, you're going to be hungrier. You're just going to feel hungrier and you're going to want to eat more. So there's some evidence the statins reduce leptin. This is not good. So the possible causes of weight gain with statins, it's reported increased waist circumference, higher abdominal fat. So where they're gaining the weight is right in their abdomen, which is just where you don't want to gain it, because when you have it in the abdomen, the thought is that you have it in the abdominal organs like your liver and your pancreas and your spleen and other important abdominal organs. And when you have it there, the fat is not inert fat. It has inflammatory compounds in it. So all those organs are subject to inflammatory compounds that are stored in fat. So the statin use boosted the levels of ghrelin, which increases appetite and affects fat cells. The other issue is that statins increase insulin resistance. Well, we've known that for a while. The medication increased the chance of the animals developing diabetes. It was reported to induce insulin resistance. Insulin resistance makes it harder for the body to maintain or lose weight. And then altered fat cell hormones. Statins elevated the blood level of leptin and resistin, hormones produced by fat cells. Well, if you're elevating leptin, that's a good thing. But some evidence points to a link between the hormones and obesity. So results of animal studies don't always apply to humans, and they have to do more research. Is weight management different with statins versus without them? So if you're taking a statin, it's important to continue eating a balanced diet and staying physically active, such as exercising regularly. You want to do that whether or not you're taking a statin. So you want to stay physically active, exercise regularly, getting in at least 150 minutes of moderate activity a week, eat plenty of fiber, get plenty of sleep, limiting portion size to manage calorie intake, swapping out low-nutrient foods for more nutritious alternatives, staying hydrated, and avoiding food and drinks that are high in added sugar. So there's no best statin for weight management since the medications are prescribed to help lower cholesterol levels, not to decrease or change body weight. And you have to talk to your doctor about what the best statin is for you. So there's some evidence that suggests that people taking statins often gain weight after they start the medication. Weight gain might be primarily caused by dietary changes rather than the medication itself. And researchers are still investigating the link between statins and weight gain. So why do you think it is? So let's think about how statins work. Statins lower, they're very effective at lowering cholesterol. They will make it so that they block HMG-CoA reductase. So you're going to have more cholesterol in your blood, or you're gonna have less cholesterol in your blood. What do you use cholesterol for? Cholesterol, remember, is important for building cell membranes on every single cell in your body. So if you don't have enough cholesterol, you're not gonna rebuild cells as well. So what cells do you need to rebuild? Well, the big ones that you need to rebuild are your muscles and tendons and ligaments, because they get used all the time. So because of their use, you're breaking bonds, you're making ATP, and you're causing inflammation. So your body is always building, breaking down and building up muscle cells. So if you don't have enough cholesterol, you have a harder time building up and breaking down muscle cells. So when you don't rebuild muscle cells, then the worst thing is you can get rhabdomyolysis, where you get that severe muscle breakdown where myoglobin spills into your blood and blocks up your kidneys and can give you kidney failure. But way before that rhabdomyolysis is rare, but it can happen. And if you take coenzyme Q10, you're somewhat less likely to get it, but rhabdomyolysis is definitely something that can happen. But most people don't get rhabdomyolysis, but a lot of people do get joint pain and body aches, and those are really common side effects, muscle pain and joint pain while they take statins. And again, that's because you're using your muscles and bones and joints all the time. And when you use them, there's a cost for their use. And so Your body has ways to rebuild those things, to build more. When you use a muscle, you rebuild muscle cells. That's how you get strong. You get not only do you get hypertrophy, which means the growth of the muscle, you get hyperplasia, which is you add cells. If you're going to add cells to your muscles, you need cholesterol. You need cholesterol to build the cell membranes around those cells. And if you lower cholesterol too much, you're not going to have enough cells to rebuild. You're not going to have the building blocks to rebuild those cells. And so now you're going to have muscles that are more ineffective, and they don't rebuild as well. And you get inflammation and pain because you're using muscles that are weaker and you're not able to rebuild them. So that's one of the things, that's one of the mechanisms there. Then the whole insulin resistance thing. Once again, you're building cells. You need cholesterol to build cells. In order to be insulin sensitive, you need to have a healthy cell that has cholesterol as part of the phospholipid matrix of the cell membrane, and insulin needs to be able to bond to it, to insulin receptors, and also blood sugar needs to go in and out of the cell because you want to have a nice fluid cell membrane. If you don't have enough cholesterol, you can't build nice fluid cell membranes. And if that happens anywhere in your body, you can't bond insulin as easily. So you don't have the communication between your blood and blood sugar and the cell, and blood sugar can't get in and out the way that it's supposed to. And if it doesn't get in, it raises the blood sugar in your cell. So now what do you got? You got insulin resistance because the cholesterol, the blocked cholesterol is not able to rebuild cells. So you don't have a place for insulin to bond. When you don't have insulin bonding, you don't have sugar entering into the cells as effectively, and you have insulin resistance and you have higher blood sugar. Now you have higher blood sugar. This is crazy because you have higher blood sugar. What happens when you get higher blood sugar? The insulin, which is now not bonding, it's seeing all this extra blood sugar in your blood and is looking in and saying, "Hey, Charlie, what do you want me to do with extra blood sugar? I can't get into the cells." Well, if you can't get into the cells, you've got to send it somewhere else. So let's send it to the fat cells. We've just got to store it. So insulin causes the extra sugar in your blood to turn into fat, which can paradoxically raise your cholesterol. I don't know if that happens, but that may be one of the reasons why they see, oh, the statins aren't lowering your cholesterol enough. Now let's give you a PCSK9 inhibitor, and that'll lower your cholesterol more. So because the PCSK9s don't, they are still pulling cholesterol out of your blood, so you still have less of a way to, rebuild your cells because you have lower cholesterol in your blood. But if you have the PCSK9 inhibitor, now your blood is filtering through your liver, which has more LDL receptors on it. So even though cholesterol may be rising a bit because you're on a statin, the excess is going to get pulled out because you have so many more LDL receptors in your liver. So your cholesterol definitely goes down. So you continue to have this problem of low cholesterol. And we talk about type 3 diabetes. Type 3 diabetes is when you have blood sugar control issues in your brain. And what happens when you have type 3 diabetes? Dementia. So the other place you need to build cells all the time is your nerve cells, because your nerves are always getting used. When you use your brain, you have neuroplasticity, so you're always learning new things. And you need your brain cells to be able to function, and you need them to be able to regenerate, and you need to be able to create new neural pathways all the time, because you're always processing information every day, and you have to remember stuff. And in order to do that, you have to make new neural pathways and therefore more nerve cells. And what do you need for that? Cholesterol. So if you lower your cholesterol, you're not going to be able to create more neural pathways. And you can wind up getting various forms of cognitive issues. So, and then you can have the blood sugar issues in your brain. If you don't get adequate glucose into the cells in your brain, then you're not going to be able to think. Your brain sucks up glucose like anything. And if you lower your carbs too much, you're going to have brain fog. So you need some glucose in your brain. And if the glucose is extracellular in your brain, when you have sugar outside the brain, it causes oxidative damage. And so then you have degeneration of the nerve cells in your brain. And there's your type 3 diabetes. And again, you know, if you have extracellular glucose, insulin's going to look at it. It can't get the glucose into the cells. Your cells don't work as well. And again, you're going to store fat elsewhere in your body. So that's an issue. So lowering cholesterol too much is an issue. And the question is, are we looking at it all wrong? Elevated cholesterol may just be hereditary. And if it's not oxidized and the person doesn't have coronary artery disease or doesn't have atherosclerosis anywhere in the body, it's probably not a big deal. If your cholesterol is large and buoyant, it's unlikely to stick to the inside of your blood vessels and cause cardiovascular disease. So do you need to do anything about that? That's the question. So if you see somebody, for example, has low triglycerides, high HDL, and high LDL, do you really need to be so concerned about it? That's when sometimes I will suggest that the patient get themselves a calcium scoring test. And a calcium scoring test, it's controversial because calcium scoring, just because you don't have any visible plaque doesn't mean that you don't have damage to arteries. But the converse is, just because you do have visible plaque doesn't mean it's doing anything to you. Because if you have a calcium score that's high, say it's 1,000, over 1,000, they tell you, well, you have some plaque in your LAD, your lower left anterior descending artery, maybe your right circumflex or whichever coronary artery it is. So you have some plaque that's deposited there. Is that coronary artery patent? That is blood easily flowing through it? Because if it is, you don't have to do anything about it. Because if the atherosclerosis is not, the atherosclerosis does not sit on the outside of the endothelium. The endothelium is the covering of the inside of your blood vessels. The atherosclerosis is underneath the outside of your the tube. So the lumen is the passageway through your artery, and the lumen is lined with endothelium. And so if the cholesterol and the plaque is sitting under the lumen and you still get blood going through, it's not a problem. It's when the cholesterol starts to break through that lumen and starts to actually block the artery that it's a problem. So you can have a high, calcium score and be perfectly fine. And you can have a low calcium score and not be fine. That's why it's controversial. But on the other hand, if you have high cholesterol and you get a calcium scoring test and it's extremely low or zero, I've had people with high cholesterol and their calcium score is zero. They genetically don't lay down cholesterol in their coronary arteries. So do they really need to take a statin? That's a risk-benefit ratio. And, you know, there are a lot of cardiovascular practitioners are like, you have to get cholesterol down at all costs. It's the devil. I don't believe that, because cholesterol, we know what it is. It helps you to build every single cell in your body. It's a precursor to vitamin D. If you lower somebody's cholesterol too much, they're not going to be able to make vitamin D. And you need vitamin D for what? Every cell in your body. You need it for building bones. So I'm wondering if there's a correlation between taking statins and reduced bone density, because you're reducing someone's vitamin D level. Now, you see somebody's vitamin D level low, you can give them vitamin D to take, which I do for most of my patients, and I take vitamin D myself. So that's not as much of an issue, but a lot of people aren't getting checked for that. So, you know, if your doctor doesn't check your vitamin D level and you're on a statin, you're not getting checked for that. And I will tell you that statins, any cholesterol medication, can lower your vitamin D level because it blocks cholesterol production. Cholesterol is a precursor to vitamin D. The other thing cholesterol is a precursor to is all of your reproductive hormones. So if you're at a disadvantage because you're getting older, you know, you're postmenopausal or you're an older gentleman as well, you're not going to have as much testosterone, estrogen, progesterone, and your quality of life is not going to be as good without those hormones. So you're not going to be able to make them. So there really is a risk-benefit analysis here. Is it really, do you really need to take those statins or PCSK9 inhibitors? So the other thing is, you may be making cholesterol because you have oxidative stress, that you have stress in general, and you have oxidative stress to your arteries. So what you do is you help to reduce your oxidative burden. And how do you do that? By eating antioxidants. eating antioxidants and reducing stress. Remember, stress creates an oxidative burden, because when you're running around with high cholesterol or high cortisol all the time, cortisol comes from your adrenal glands. It pushes your body to have the energy. It runs around your body looking for stuff to break down, to turn into sugar, to put into your blood so you have energy to run away from the bear or do whatever it is that you want to do. But you have to remember, cortisol comes at a cost. Cortisol breaks down tissue. And when you have tissue breakdown, you have oxidative damage. And so if you have a high antioxidant load in your body is always chasing after oxidative damage to your body. So people naturally make their own antioxidants. They're just very good at, some bodies are very good at it. And that's why you see incredible longevity in people. So happy birthday, Saul, again, who turned 99 last week. And we're hoping that we make it to 100. I'm looking forward to his 100th birthday party. So one of the really good things to do is to reduce oxidative stress. And the first thing to do is reduce stress. So how do you reduce stress? You have to look at your life and figure out, where are the pockets of stress in your life? What is causing you stress? Are there ways to cut back on that? Can you do less stuff? Can you cut back on work? Can you cut back on some of the tasks that you do? Can you lead a more paced life? Can you do things that increase your happiness? Can you spend more time with family or friends? Can you go to the beach or the ocean or spend more time in nature, whatever that looks like for you? Can you meditate? Can you do yoga? Can you do get massage, acupuncture, anything else that can reduce your stress? So doing fun things in your life that reduce stress. Reducing stress will reduce your cortisol, which will reduce your oxidative damage, which will lower your cholesterol. There, I said it. Then, of course, you want to eat foods that have antioxidants in them, and you want to avoid foods that cause oxidative stress and damage. So what's going to cause oxidative stress and damage? Ultra-processed food, seed oils, hydrogenated fats, too much sugar, too much refined flour. That's going to cause oxidative damage. And when you have oxidative damage, your cholesterol tends to go up. So if you take care of the oxidative damage, your cholesterol doesn't need to be high, because it doesn't need to repair stuff. So you eat more antioxidants by eating, guess what, fruits and vegetables. Just make sure they're not from an unknown source and that you're getting from your local growers, so you're avoiding the cyclosporiasis outbreak. But anyway, but eating produce in general is going to help you, because it has lots and lots of antioxidants in it. Some foods are super high in antioxidants. Tomatoes, for example, have lycopene in them, a great antioxidant. Pomegranates have ellagic acid in them, which helps to lower cholesterol, probably because it's an antioxidant. AMLA, which we're going to talk about in a little bit, is also high in antioxidants. Any of your berries and cherries are high in antioxidants. A lot of the fruits that are available right now are high in antioxidants. Leafy greens are high in antioxidants. And once again, if you're going to eat leafy greens, it's a good idea to get them fresh and local at this time, because we're not sure exactly where the cyclosporiasis is coming from. But leafy greens are so important to your health. So reducing oxidative stress is really the way to go. And then there are supplements you can take that reduce oxidation. Astaxanthin is one of my favorites. Vitamin C, vitamin E, zinc. Zinc helps with tissue repair, and vitamin C and vitamin E are great antioxidants. Of course, if you take vitamin E, make sure that it has tocotrienols in it. Otherwise, if it's just alpha-tocopherol, it can cause oxidative stress. So tocotrienols are your friends. So lowering cholesterol is not as important as protecting your body from oxidative stress. And to do that, you need to reduce stress, reduce starch and sugar, reduce ultra-processed foods, and eat lots of produce. Eat high antioxidant foods, and maybe take some antioxidant supplements. All right, so let's talk about some other things that you can do and take to help with cholesterol. So berberine and cholesterol. Berberine has been shown to decrease total cholesterol, triglycerides, and LDL cholesterol. It may also help to improve your HDL cholesterol levels, so it may support heart health from that side. Some studies have found that it raises HDL in women while it lowers it in men. And so there must be a hormonal factor there. Berberine has been used in traditional medicine to treat health conditions like digestive issues, inflammation, and infection, and may help prevent cancer, diabetes, inflammation, and osteoporosis, and work as a muscle relaxant. So that's a hard-working supplement there. And it can also help to lower blood sugar, because berberine acts on the liver. It's a cholagogue and choleretic. It moves bile through the liver and increases bile production. And so that's why it can help to prevent all those conditions. And so if you're lowering blood sugar, it can also help to lower A1C. The measure that shows the level of damage to arteries or to cells in your body as a result of high blood sugar. So if you have elevated blood sugar levels and cholesterol levels, berberine might be a good choice. So berberine is a possibility. People, and there's some GLP-1 activity in berberine. And I tell people, look, if you want a GLP-1, you need to take a GLP-1. Berberine is not going to work nearly as well as the GLP-1, but it's also that there are some studies that show if you take a certain dose of berberine before meals, that it can help your A1C. It can help with fat loss. I don't think it's nearly as powerful in that way as GLP-1s. But if you take it and then you do all the other things, you know, good diet, you know, low glycemic diet, fruits and vegetables, whole grains, leafy greens, legumes, if you tolerate them, high quality dairy, if you tolerate it, high quality protein. If you do all of those things, and you take berberine, berberine might give you an edge. But expect that if you want to change your cholesterol levels and if you want to change your blood sugar levels, you're going to need to eat a really good diet and get exercise and reduce your stress. Those are the main things that you're going to do. All right, let's talk about amla. So amla, that's an impressive herb. It's an impressive, hardworking herb. It's an Ayurvedic herb. It's used traditionally in Ayurvedic medicine, which is the medicine from India. So there was a published study in the BMC Complementary and Alternative Medicine that found that supplementation with amla, also known as Indian gooseberry, has a significant impact on dyslipidemia. Dyslipidemia is defined as abnormally high levels of cholesterol and lipids in the blood and is considered a major risk factor for atherosclerosis, which is the buildup of cholesterol and lipids on the artery walls. In the random placebo-controlled studies, they studied nearly 100 patients who had dyslipidemia and were given either 500 milligrams of a patented amla extract or placebo twice a day for 12 weeks. So they took 1,000 milligrams of amla when they took it. It's standardized for polyphenol and diacylglycerides of alpha-linolenic acid, which is an omega-3 fatty acid. And results showed that after 12 weeks of supplementation, subjects taking the amla extract experienced significant reductions in total cholesterol, triglycerides, low-density lipoprotein cholesterol, and very low-density lipoprotein cholesterol compared to placebo. There was also a 39% reduction in the atherogenic index of plasma, which is a key indicator of cardiac health. So the combination of high cholesterol, modern life stress, and widely available junk food are factors that are known to aggravate cardiovascular disease. The sacred Indian gooseberry, or amla, has been used for centuries in many Ayurvedic formulations as a rasayanic, which is something known for its all-around health benefit. Rasayanic would be either a Hindi or Sanskrit word for an adaptogen. So amla is known as an adaptogen. An adaptogen is a herb that helps you adapt to life. So that means it's good for a whole bunch of stuff. And so it's known for its all-around health benefits and outstanding safety. And we're realizing it's a powerful cardiac protector, even in stubborn cases of unhealthy lipid profiles. So amla is something that you could consider taking. I would talk to your doctor about it, talk to your friendly naturopath about it. I will admit that I am taking amla now. I thought that amla, because amla has some ACE inhibiting properties. And so I was taking it and I thought it was making me dizzy. And so I stopped taking it. But that's not what was making me dizzy. What was making me dizzy is either I had my neck was out of alignment and or I had Lyme disease. And when I treated the Lyme disease, I got better. The dizziness coming from my head got much better. And I started taking amla again and I'm okay. So I'm taking 1,000 milligrams of amla a day. And I'm taking capsules right now, and I'm going to get, it's a relatively economical supplement. I'm going to get powder, which I'm going to put into tea or smoothies, and that's how I'm going to have it. And that's an economical way to use it. So amla can help lower your cholesterol and improve your lipid profiles. It's not going to have the toxic side effects because it's also an antioxidant. It's not going to have the toxic side effects that your cholesterol lowering medications are going to have. And it also helps to lower blood pressure. And high blood pressure is a risk factor for atherosclerosis because when you have turbulent blood flow beating against arteries from high blood pressure, you're likely to have more oxidative damage. Once you have oxidative damage, then your body's going to want to go ahead and repair that. And here come your cholesterol, your platelets, and your calcium to create plaques. So the antioxidants in amla are going to help to protect you from that. So I feel good about taking because it's an ancient herb. It's an adaptogen. It helps with a lot of different things and helps to optimize cholesterol profile, you know, lipid profiles. So I'm excited about taking it. One thing I'm less excited about is red yeast rice. So people go and they're told by their doctors, take red yeast rice. And, the doctors don't know much about the red yeast rice. And they just say, they know it's a supplement. Okay, if you won't take my statins, go take red yeast rice. The thing is that red yeast rice has lovastatin in it. It is a statin. So just be aware of that. You can get the same side effects. You still need to take CoQ10. However, it does have some benefits that the statins don't. So red yeast rice may help your heart and reduce cholesterol levels, inflammation, and cancer cell growth and risk of metabolic syndrome, and also has some downside because it has statins in it. It's turned up on pharmacy shelves within the last few decades. It's been prized for hundreds of years as purported top natural remedy for high cholesterol. Red yeast rice is one of the few natural supplements that contain active ingredients virtually identical to those found in prescription medicines. Lovastatin, a statin. Plus, the benefits of red yeast rice extend beyond lowering cholesterol levels, with emerging research showing that it may benefit inflammation, metabolic syndrome, blood sugar levels, and more. So red yeast rice is a type of fermented rice that's produced using specific species of mold, Monascus rubra or Monascus purpureus. That's why the main ingredient in it is called monacolin. It's been used in traditional Chinese medicine for centuries for its health-promoting properties. It has the compound monacolin K, which is the same active ingredient found in prescription cholesterol medications like lovastatin. For this reason, it's often used as a cost-effective alternative to pricey medications to help reduce cholesterol levels and support heart health. But there are other beneficial effects as well. They're ranging from reduced cancer cell growth to improved blood sugar and insulin levels. It's commonly sold as an over-the-counter supplement marketed to help manage cholesterol and improve overall health. Benefits may be improved heart health, reduced risk of metabolic syndrome, decreased inflammation, and reduced cancer risk. Heart disease is a serious condition that affects millions and is estimated to account for 31.5% of deaths around the world. High cholesterol, one of the main risk factors for heart disease, can cause arteries to narrow and stiffen, it leading to an increased risk of heart attack and stroke. So red yeast rice is commonly used as a natural remedy to help lower cholesterol levels and promote heart health and can sometimes have fewer adverse side effects than prescription drugs used to treat high cholesterol, but sometimes not. I have patients who come in and they take red yeast rice and they get the same side effects that they get with prescription statins. So one review of 21 studies found that red yeast rice was effective at reducing levels of total and LDL bad cholesterol, as well as triglycerides and blood pressure when combined with statin drugs. So if you take the red yeast rice with a statin, which is like just taking a higher dose of a statin, the monacolin K may also help improve endothelial function, or the flexibility and adaptability of your blood vessels, which is key to maintaining your vascular and heart health. And may also help with metabolic syndrome, which is the cluster of conditions that increase your risk for chronic conditions like heart disease, diabetes, and stroke. Some of the criteria for metabolic syndrome include high blood pressure, excess body fat, increased blood sugar, and alterations in cholesterol triglycerides. Several studies have found that red yeast rice may help treat some of these risk factors and could be used as a natural treatment to aid in prevention. One of the most well-documented effects is the ability to lower cholesterol. It shows it can effectively reduce both total and LDL cholesterol. There was an 18-week study that showed that a supplement that had red yeast rice in it was able to reduce blood sugar, insulin levels, and systolic blood pressure. Plus, an 8-week study looked at the effects of red yeast rice on mice fed a high-fat diet compared with a control group. It found that red yeast rice was able to prevent increases in cholesterol levels and body weight. So red yeast rice is also found to possibly reduce inflammation, which is a normal immune response designed to protect your body against acute infection and foreign invaders, but sustained inflammation is thought to contribute to chronic conditions like diabetes, cancer, and heart disease. Studies show that supplementing with red yeast rice may help reduce inflammation and promote better health in the long term. There was a study in 50 people with metabolic syndrome, and it showed that taking a supplement containing red yeast rice and olive leaf extract, something that I take also, for 8 weeks reduced levels of oxidative stress, which is a key cause of chronic inflammation, by like 20%. Similarly, another study found that giving red yeast rice extracts to kidney-damaged rats, which reduces specific levels of proteins involved in inflammation in the body. And red yeast rice may have anti-cancer properties. The current research is limited to animal and test tube studies. There is some evidence that suggests that red yeast rice may help reduce the growth and spread of cancer cells. One study found that giving mice with prostate cancer red yeast rice powder significantly decreased tumor volume compared with a control group. So more research, of course, is needed. So the downside, the monocholine K is the active component in red yeast rice, which is commonly extracted and used in cholesterol-lowering statin medications. So the FDA took action against several companies selling red yeast rice containing high amounts of monocholine K, noting that it's illegal to market these products as supplements in the United States because it's considered to be a prescription drug. So red yeast rice supplements are still legal, but they must only contain trace amounts of monocholine K, which means they're not going to work as well. However, as recently as 2011, some red yeast rice supplements have been found to contain high amounts of monocholine K. As a consumer, it's impossible for you to know how much monocholine K a supplement may contain because only the amount of red yeast rice is disclosed on the label. So either it's going to have too much monocholine K in it, which means it's basically a statin, or it's not, which means it's going to work meh for lowering your cholesterol. The FDA doesn't regulate food supplements, of course, the way that drugs are regulated, and nutrition claims may not be based on scientific evidence. So you have to talk to your healthcare provider about taking it. So it's not always going to work because, again, you buy the red yeast rice, you don't know how much monocholine K is in it, and there might not be enough to lower your cholesterol. So supplementing with it can cause some adverse effects. It can cause gastrointestinal problems like bloating, gas, and stomach pain. And it can also cause muscle problems, liver toxicity, and allergic reactions because of the statins that are in it. So it can definitely cause the muscle problems and joint pain and stuff. The research is limited on long-term study. You probably shouldn't take it if you're nursing or you're pregnant. If you notice any adverse symptoms after taking red yeast rice, consider decreasing the dose or discontinuing. And because it has monocholine K, it can interact with a statin if you're taking it. If you're already taking a statin, you may not want to take it because it's additive. It's like you're taking a higher dose of the statin. It doesn't make sense to take red yeast rice and a statin. If you're taking a statin, you should stick with the statin and figure out with your doctor what an optimal dose for you is. If you're taking any medications, it's a good idea to talk with a trusted healthcare professional before starting red yeast rice. Red yeast rice that's not carefully cultivated can have a byproduct called citronin, which is a mycotoxin that's produced by certain kinds of mold. That I didn't know. It can cause kidney failure in animals and affect gene expression in humans. So there was an assessment. Of 11 red yeast rice products, and they found 4 of the 11 did have citronin in it. So that's concerning. So it's available in capsule or tablets, sometimes in combination with other ingredients like omega-3 fatty acids and coenzyme Q10. And you can get them in health food stores. And people take between 200 and 4,800 milligrams. That's what's been studied. Usually, if somebody's taking them and they're taking them successfully and they feel okay and they want to take them, we look at around 1,200 milligrams a day, 600 twice a day. I'm not a big fan of red yeast rice, I will admit. So you have to realize the potential benefits, and remember that there is a risk of, I'm so much more comfortable with things like berberine and amla and fiber and olive leaf to help manage cholesterol, because it just doesn't have the potential side effects that red yeast rice has. So make sure you get a high quality supplement and look for a GMP, good manufacturing practices. And it meets food and drug administration criteria. And it's also nice if it's third party tested, and then you're likely to get a good quality red yeast rice. So red yeast rice may support heart health and reduce cholesterol levels, inflammation, cancer cell growth, and a risk of factors of metabolic syndrome. But the supplement has a number of potential downsides, including it's basically a statin. So you work closely with your healthcare practitioner to decide if this is a supplement that you can take. All right, so there's that. All right, so we only have a minute or so left. So my advice is, if your doctor is coming after you to tell you that you need to take a statin because of your high cholesterol, it's really going to depend what's going on with you. If you have active cardiovascular disease, like you've already had a major cardiac event, like you've had a heart attack or you've had a stroke, it may be a good idea to lower cholesterol, because we know that you have enough oxidative stress that you can easily block your arteries. And it may be wise to do something about those cholesterol levels. But if you can do it by reducing stress, because you can lower cholesterol by reducing stress, by eating less starch and sugar, by avoiding processed sugars and processed flour, by eating lots more fiber, by eating fruits and vegetables and whole grains, taking supplements like flax, ground flaxseed, hemp seed, chia seed, all of those can help to lower cholesterol. That helps to sweep the excess cholesterol out of your body. And then you consume a lot of antioxidants, then your body doesn't need to make as much cholesterol, because it's not going to make the cholesterol to repair oxidative stress. So if you eat berries, if you eat deeply colored fruits and vegetables, especially your berries and cherries, if you drink pomegranate juice or eat pomegranate, if you take leafy greens have all the carotenoids in them. And tomatoes have lycopene in them. They're all going to help support your cardiovascular health. And you may lower your cholesterol just from doing that. But the big things are stress reduction, healthy diet, and regular exercise. That's what you need to do. So on that note, I'm going to let you go. You have been listening to Radio Naturopath, the talk show about health and natural medicine. I am Fran Storch, ND, naturopathic physician. You can email me with questions and comments at radionaturopath@gmail.com. If you'd like to listen to this show at another time, you can check out our podcast at whus.org, iTunes, Spotify, Patreon, Buzzsprout, and YouTube. You may also watch the recorded Facebook Live episode at Fran Storch, ND for 30 days. The views expressed on this program do not reflect the views of the staff, management, or licensee of this station. The information presented on the show should not be construed as medical advice or direction. If you're having a medical condition, please consult with your physician. Thank you for listening to Radio Naturopath, your show where you can learn about the best of science and nature. We'll be back with more Radio Naturopath next week at 91.7 FM, WHUS stores, and WHUS.org.